from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Sunday Yak shows were filled this weekend with discussions about Harriet Myers, President Bush's selection to replace Sandra Day O'Connor on the United States Supreme Court. And they brought up almost every aspect, the pros and cons, the conservatives opposing her, and the I don't know who's supporting her, but whoever else, Harry Reid and the Democratic leader in the Senate? Yeah, okay. Anyway, one fact, you know, they brought up her religion, they brought up her work in Dallas, law firm thing, her close association with the president. By the way, if you want to be appointed to a high position or nominated to a high position by the president, be the head of his search committee. Dick Cheney was head of his search committee to select a vice president running mate for him, selected himself. Harriet Myers was head of the search committee to select a Supreme Court nominee. And it's her. It's a good way to get in. But the other salient point about her that seems to have escaped much public notice, because it's so darn trivial, is that she's what, 50, 60? 660. Never married. That's all it says. Never married, never had children. Now, it's fine. I don't, you know, people make their choices. But Condoleezza Rice, never married, never had children. So President Bush is saying, basically, he's a fan of strong women as long as they never marry and never have children. It's all you can take from that, I guess, unless you can take more. This, ladies and gentlemen, appears to be the verdict. After the hurricanes that ripped the Gulf Coast, comes this devastating earthquake in Pakistan, and the threat brooded about widely of a bird flu pandemic. All you can conclude really is this is not really a good home planet for us. You know, it was a good start, but we really should get ourselves to another planet, just for the poignancy and puissance and other P words of spending the money to arrive there, settling down, saying, yeah, this is the place. All right, what were we thinking on that Earth deal? And then, you know, the big sandstorm or whatever erupts, and what was this? This wasn't in the reports. This wasn't in the reconnaissance memos. Shoot, we'd be better off with hurricanes. Hello, welcome to the show.
soft spot for cops who are robots. And I don't know where this is going, but I've got a feeling I'll do the driving from now on. Sometimes we stare at the stars from so. How else could they glow on for so long? We're out. The jukebox plays Jumpin' Jack Flash. She says I love Johnny Cash, the man in red. I turn my head and pretend not to hear what she said. And I don't know where this is going, but I've got a feeling
from the edge of America, from the home of the homeless. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. You know that stories that have come out now, well, 5 weeks later, make it clear that there were no murders inside the Superdome in New Orleans, Louisiana, in the wake of Katrina. You do know that. Those have been published. If you want to check that out, you could. I think I linked to some of them at Eat the Press at HuffingtonPost.com, but they've been out for a few days. No murders, no confirmed murders at the Superdome in the wake of Katrina. Despite all the, now, of course, those were stories that were widely reported and widely repeated, even by the mayor and the police chief of New Orleans at the time. So, can't quite blame the media for repeating them and not saying, sure? You have confirmation of that, sir? Now comes this from Knight Ridder newspapers, Dateline New Orleans. Among the rumors that spread, reports that gunmen were taking pot shots at rescue helicopters stood out for their senselessness. On September 1st, crucial rescue efforts were delayed as word of such attacks spread. Now, more than a month later, representatives from the Air Force, Coast Guard, Department of Homeland Security, and Louisiana Air National Guard say they have yet to confirm a single incidence of gunfire at helicopters. Not one. Nay, uno. Likewise, members of several rescue crews who were told to halt operations say there is no evidence they were under fire. Many rescue workers said they heard gunfire, although one report of somebody hearing gunfire turned out to be a gas pump popping repeatedly. That from a reputable news source a couple weeks ago. But so many rumors were swirling, the facts still haven't been sorted out. On the morning of September 1st, Mike Sonnier was directing rescue helicopters at his company, Acadian Ambulance, when one of his pilots called to say the military had suspended flights after gunfire was reported in the air near the Superdome. Should he continue rescuing sick evacuees or suspend his company flights? Saunier immediately shut down flights. "Until I can confirm that this did or didn't happen, it's not a chance I can take," he said. When he checked with the National Guard about 2 hours later, he was told it was okay to fly. At that point, he resumed operations. A Coast Guard spokeswoman at the City Emergency Operations Center told the Associated Press at the time, at every hospital, there were reports that as the helicopters come in, people are shooting at them. Two Coast Guard spokesmen who were asked in recent days about helicopter shooting said there were no incidents of any Coast Guard personnel or vehicles taking fire. "We don't know of any shots ever fired directly at us," says Captain Bob Muller, commander of the Guard in New Orleans. But there were a number of reports of shots fired in the air. Lieutenant Pete Schneider, a spokesman for the National Guard, said it was a civilian who told guardsmen in the area that shots had been fired. The spokesman says flights continued, but a spokesperson for the Department of Homeland Security contradicted that statement. Because of reports of gunfire, a FEMA support team ordered Florida Task Force 1 using boats to reach the stranded to stop work for the entire day unless law enforcement protection could be found. That help never came. Meanwhile, thousands of people were stuck in attics and on roofs. "We had just had a very successful day before," spokesperson said. "It definitely slowed down our rescue efforts." FEMA sent mixed messages in recent days as to whether rescue efforts were placed on hold. That's surprising. Some who were in New Orleans that day described moments of real peril. A cancer doctor at Tulane Hospital said a sniper shot at him and its military escorts in the street as they evacuated patients. He said the gunman was in a nearby parking deck shooting at the Charity Hospital emergency room. And Charity Hospital executive Ed Burke said he saw a sniper fire a shot at the emergency room from a parking garage the day before. Many other stories don't pan out. Reports that an employee of the Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fisheries was shot during a rescue mission were false, according to a department spokesman. One man was arrested for shooting a rifle in the air as a helicopter flew by, but that was several days after the major rescue operations. This report on how the helicopter shooting stories morphed during one day. Early in the morning of September 1st, NPR reported that a Chinook helicopter was shot at. That afternoon, NPR reported that search and rescue teams had been shot at. By 5 p.m. on Fox, the Chinook had become a Sikorsky. That evening, Keith Olbermann on MSNBC opened his show talking about, quote, "an unknown number of residents shooting at and threatening the very people trying to save them," unquote. By the next night, U.S. Representative Charlie Melanson, Democrat of Louisiana, in an MSNBC interview said matter-of-factly that bus drivers and helicopters were being shot at. "You have to understand there's a lack of communication, the hostile nature of the crowd, the people looting, shooting at people," says Acadian pilot Mark Creswell. He believes the sound of gunfire from people roaming the streets gave rise to the widespread tales of rescue workers being targeted. The debate isn't over. The Department of Homeland Security plans to investigate whether helicopters were targeted, as well as the extent to which rescue operations were delayed. The department hopes, according to a spokeswoman, quote, "to achieve clarity on this issue," unquote. Let's hope that the Department of Homeland Security, ladies and gentlemen, achieves some clarity on any issue, one would hope. This from, now switching gears dramatically, the determination of countries across the Middle East and Asia to develop nuclear arsenals and other weapons of mass destruction is laid bare by a secret British intelligence document, which has been seen by the British newspaper, The Guardian. More than, just savor this list. of people who are in the market for nukes. More than 360 private companies, university departments, and government organizations in eight countries, including, hello, the Pakistan High Commission in London, are identified as having procured goods or technology for use in weapons programs. Universities? Does UCLA need nuclear weapons? They need a good basketball team. The length of the list compiled by MI5, the British spy agency, suggests that the arms trade supermarket is bigger than has so far been publicly realized. MI5 warns against exports to organizations in Iran, Pakistan, India, Israel, Syria, and Egypt, and to beware of front companies in the United Arab Emirates, which appears to be a hub for the nuclear trade. Hey, they're a friend of ours. The document, entitled Companies and Organizations of Proliferation Concern, has been compiled in an attempt to prevent British companies inadvertently exporting sensitive goods or expertise to organizations covertly involved in WMD programs. Despite the large number of bodies identified, the document says the list is not complete. Companies in Malta and Cyprus could have been used as fronts for WMD programs. The document also identifies 95 Pakistani organizations and government bodies as having assisted in the country's nuclear program. Says Abdul Basit, the deputy high commissioner, it is absolute rubbish for Pakistan to be included. Does rubbish mean not true? From another British newspaper, The Independent, relief efforts to combat Hurricane Katrina. This now ties that to this. Relief efforts to combat Hurricane Katrina suffered near catastrophic failures due to endemic corruption, divisions within the military, and troop shortages caused by the Iraq War. This, according to an official American inquiry into the disaster. Funds for flood control were diverted to other projects. Desperately needed National Guardsmen were stuck in Iraq. Military personnel had to sneak off their post to help with relief efforts because their commanders had refused permission. The report was commissioned by the Office of the Secretary of Defense as an independent and critical review of what went wrong. In the analysis, it says, quote, the U.S. military has long planned for war on two fronts. This is as close as we have come to that reality since the Second World War. The results have been, their word, disastrous, unquote. The document was compiled by Stephen Henthorne, a former professor of the U.S. Army's War College. Hey, I bet they got a good football team. And an advisor to the Pentagon who was a deputy director in the Louisiana relief efforts. Excuse me? Do I have a job on the radio talking? It charts how, quote, corruption and mismanagement within the New Orleans city government, this just in, had diverted money earmarked for improving flood protection to other more vote-getting projects. See today's Washington Post, by the way, for a more complete view of how hurricane prevention and flood control projects kept getting sidetracked through decades for more attractive, more immediate payoff, attractive to voters projects, and especially economically attractive. Like, hey, more ships will come in. Past mayors and governors gambled that the long-expected big killer hurricane would never happen. That bet was lost with Hurricane Katrina, the Pentagon report says. The report states Brigadier General Michael DiBarbero, chairman of the Joint Readiness Training Center, that sounds good, at Fort Polk, Louisiana, refused permission for Special Forces units who volunteered to join relief efforts to do so. General Barbero also refused to release other troops. He did take in some families from Hurricane Katrina, but only military families living off the base. He declined to share water with the citizens of Leesville, who were out of water. The report says deployment in the Iraq War led to serious problems. Another major factor, this is quoting, in the delayed response to the hurricane aftermath was that the bulk of the Louisiana and Mississippi National Guard was deployed in Iraq. Even though all the states have compacts with each other pledging to come to the aid of the other states, it takes time, money, and effort to activate and deploy National Guard troops from other states to fill in. Unquote. Unquote, the Pentagon's own report. It concludes the one thing this disaster has demonstrated is the lack of coordinated, in-depth planning and training on all levels of government for all types of emergency contingencies. Failure to plan, this is still quoting, failure to plan and train properly has plagued U.S. efforts in Afghanistan, Iraq, and now that failure has come home to roost in the United States, unquote. We got planning. We need to plan better. We just all, can't we all get a plan? Dateline Baghdad, 1 week before Iraqis vote on a constitution. U.S. and Arab diplomats are scrambling to broker last-minute concessions from faction leaders that would persuade the Sunni Arab majority to drop its opposition to the constitution. Saudi and Jordanian officials, at the urging of the U.S. ambassador, have called on Sunni politicians to stick with negotiations until Monday. Monday is the last possible date for bargaining over the language of the constitution, which you'd think it had been approved by the parliament. It was, although it was never read to the parliament that approved it. So I guess they can change it. Monday's the deadline, because the constitution is going to be put to a vote next Saturday. Ballots are already being printed at a plant in Europe. The first of millions of copies have been distributed across Iraq. Never too late to change the language. Maybe. And from a British newspaper, The Independent, millions of Iraqis will vote on a constitution they've never seen. Increasing violence and worsening interfactional tensions hamper distribution of the document. So I guess it's okay to change the language because they'll never see it anyway. Why should they? The parliament didn't. Distribution of the constitution has begun in a few areas of Baghdad. Many other parts of the capital and the rest of the country are unlikely to receive copies. The only ones available in Tikrit, Saddam Hussein's hometown, were brought from Baghdad by Sunni politicians urging a no vote. Yeah. Just like 1789. Karen Hughes, the president's new head of public diplomacy, had a little trip over to Turkey and other parts of the Middle East to a listening tour. And on the way home, she singled out to reporters a really interesting meeting that she'd had with the Turkish Foreign Minister Abdullah Gül, who urged her to try to look at the Iraq war from the perspective of, quote, a common man in Turkey, unquote. And this is now quoting Karen Hughes. And he said, you know, for y'all, when you're talking about Iraq, war in Iraq and Iran and Syria, you're talking about countries over there. We're talking about our next door neighbors. This is from a transcript on the State Department website. Still quoting now, Karen Hughes. And it's an interesting perspective and an important perspective that I will now try to bring to our policy debate. Not that it hasn't been present, she continued, but I consider it my job to make sure it's really highlighted and considered, unquote. The fact that Turkey's over there and Iraq is right next door. She was going to bring that home and point that out. Make sure they think about that. Hughes was named to this supposedly important post, head of public diplomacy, on March 14th. But she delayed taking over for 5 months, saying she needed to stay home in Texas and see her son off to Stanford. But the Washington Post reports that from March 14th until her swearing-in, she collected $450,000 in speaking fees, $50,000 a pop. That would be nine speaking appearances. Home is as we've learned, well, certainly as the people from Louisiana have learned, it's a flexible concept. The Washington Post's early warning blog says the Pentagon sent a solicitation out last month asking for advisory and assistance services to develop, quote, a system of metrics to accurately assess U.S. progress in the war on terrorism, identify critical issues hindering progress, and develop and track action plans to resolve the issues identified, unquote. Now we're doing that. Now we're asking contractors to help us measure whether we're winning, and by the way, what are the problems and how do we deal with them? Use of the new metric software is scheduled to begin on January 1, 2006. So stand by, ladies and gentlemen. We'll know. We're going to know. And finally, at the top of the week's news, from the dog trainer, senior United States officials have begun to question a key presumption of American strategy in Iraq, that establishing democracy there will erode and ultimately eradicate the insurgency. Within the last 2 months, U.S. analysts with access to classified intelligence have started to challenge this precept, noting a significant and disturbing disconnect between advances on the political front and efforts to reduce the insurgency. Some within the administration are concluding that the quest for democracy in Iraq in its current form could actually strengthen the insurgency. The commander of U.S. forces in Iraq, Army General George Casey, has acknowledged that such a scenario is possible. Other officials, all of whom declined to be identified, because of the sensitivity of the subject, don't you know, say they share similar concerns about the referendum. Said a senior U.S. official about the Constitution referendum, it could make people on the fence a little more angry or make them come off the fence. Ouch. So, maybe we should just start airdropping leaflets. Stay on the fence.
I am not such a clever one about the latest facts. I admit I was never one adored by local lads. Not that I ever try to be a saint. I'm the type that they classify as quaint. I'm old-fashioned. I love the moonlight. I love the old-fashioned things. The sound upon a window pane, the starry song that April sings. This year's fancies are passing fancies, but sighing sighs, holding hands, my heart understands. I'm old-fashioned, but I don't mind it. That's how I want to be, as long as you agree to stay old-fashioned with me.
This is Le Show, and the FBI and the CIA are calling it the first case of espionage in the White House in modern history. You'd think that would be serious fodder for the Sunday Yak shows. I don't think one of them mentioned it. They were talking a long time about Harriet Myers, unmarried, never married, no children, and Tom DeLay and bird flu. Not a word about this. Officials tell ABC News the alleged spy worked undetected at the White House for almost 3 years. Leandro Aragoncillo, 46, was a U.S. Marine, most recently assigned to the staff of Vice President Dick Cheney. Says Dick Clark, the former White House advisor on security, I don't know of a case where the vetting broke down before and resulted in a spy being in the White House. Why wouldn't... Federal investigators say Aragoncillo, a naturalized citizen from the Philippines, used his top secret clearance to steal classified intelligence documents from White House computers. In 2000, he worked on the staff of then-Vice President Al Gore. When interviewed on Philippine television, he remarked how valued Philippine employees were at the White House. I think what they like most, he said at the time, is our integrity and loyalty. Officials say the classified material which he allegedly stole from the vice president's office included damaging dossiers on the president of the Philippines. He then passed those on to opposition politicians planning a coup. The government's lead espionage prosecutor for 26 years, John Martin, says the fact that it occurred at the White House is a matter of great concern. Last year, he left the Marines. Aragoncillo was caught by the FBI while he worked for the FBI at an intelligence center at Fort Monmouth, New Jersey. Well, that's good intelligence. According to a criminal complaint, he was arrested last month and accused of downloading more than 100 classified documents from FBI computers. The information was allegedly transferred mostly by emails. Officials say he has started to cooperate. He has admitted to spying while working on the staff of Vice President Cheney's office. As I say, it's odd. There'd be so little about it on the Sunday Let's Chew This Over shows. But you can imagine somebody's digging into it somewhere, subterraneanly.
Next, intimate tales of America's first underground vice president. The action-packed diary of the man who's less than a heartbeat away from history.
Dick Cheney.
Confidential.
Confidential.
Confidential. Confidential.
There are no leaves around the secure undisclosed location. So the only way the approach of autumn impinges on my finely tuned consciousness is the dropping of shoes. The Iraqi Constitution is one of those little pieces of conceptual footwear. Tell you, Sisyphus didn't have heavier lifting. First we got him to sit down together, then to avoid all sorts of deadlines enshrined in Jerry Bremer's neat little transitional law deal. Then to avoid actually reading the full text of the Constitution to the Parliament. Then to change the rules to make it harder to defeat. And then this week, after John Bolton couldn't keep the hairless Yorkies at the UN from yapping up a storm, we had to get our Iraqi friends to change the rules back again. All this while the constituent in chief was busy doing his look how much I care about the Gulf Coast tour. Plus, with Mike Brown doing a heck of a less of a heck of a job, I had a whole new pair of arms to twist over at FEMA to make sure the reconstruction contracts weren't subjected to the unconscionable delays of competitive bidding. But those were just someone else's shoes dropping in the autumnal breeze. And some of my own were hitting the floorboards. Not just because Lynn had gotten the Navy SEALs to reorganize my secure undisclosed closet. The minute I walked into my office early Thursday morning, I knew something bad was up. Not only were my knees still aching from the aneurysm surgery requiring me to up the painkiller dose one more tick, but a pair of flat feet from the FBI were busily monkeying with the office computers. If I wanted the FBI to know what I knew, hell, I'd tell them. Thursday, 10:17 a.m. Can I help you, fellas?
No, sir.
No, sir. We're doing just fine. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. We would like to know if you have the manual for the database program on this machine.
Mm-hmm. Well, isn't that interesting? Have you tried calling tech support or using online help?
Well, no, sir, but...
Let's just say I make myself comfortable and ask you fellas a question. How'd you happen to get into this facility?
We had the proper paperwork for the Navy folks to wave us in case that's relevant to anything.
It's relevant to this, G-Man Jr. Paperwork can get you by the Navy goons, but this office is under the protection of a little thing called the Secret Service.
Well, in the present climate, sir, Homeland Security trumps Secret Service.
Oh, good point, little Hoover. The last time I looked, FBI was a long trip on the Metro from Homeland Security.
Mr. Cheney, it's well known in the Bureau that you like to freelance. But I think in the current circumstances, it's going to be easier for everyone if you do this our way.
Listen, Flatfoot, you think I'd be in this office with this staff working the accounts I'm working at home and abroad if I like to do things by the book? Hell, we even throw out the manuals for the software. Now, maybe you could just give me a heads up on the computer removal operation you've got going here before the private security I've summoned on my belt pager make contact with your hands with extreme prejudice to your knuckles.
Mr. Vice...
I'll handle this. You just keep unplugging.
Roger that.
One more thing.
Yes, sir?
We don't roger. Mr. Vice President, a certain Mr. Leandro Aragoncillo used to work in this office.
Leandro. Filipino gentleman?
Yes, sir, although we don't use ethnic ID for any purposes other than diversity indexation.
Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, when he left here, didn't he go over to your shop?
Yes, sir, he did. But he didn't access any secure information from our computers.
We've got a protocol in place to prevent that.
Will you... Apparently, he was accessing secure information on your computers and feeding that material to opposition figures in the Philippine political structure. Allegedly.
Mm-hmm. And somehow all that Filipino nonsense justifies you guys coming in here and playing Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. with the security of our country. What are they smoking over in your shop?
We're non-smokers, sir. Ever since Mr. Hoover's day.
All right, kid, don't get his panties in a twist. Go take the computers. Have fun with them. I'll stay here and have this account closed before you guys figure out where the start key is.
Well, there is no...
Oh, yeah? And how are you going to do that?
Simple, Shamus. The phone still works. When you spend half your waking life beating the pants off the CIA at three-dimensional chess, finding little FBI teeth sunk into your own trouser legs is, at best, a pesky distraction. Still, the idea that Bob Mueller's shop would suddenly know at least some of what I knew just didn't sit right with me. So I decided to do some digital perambulation, that is, let my fingers do the walking, over to my predecessor. After all, I inherited our friend Leandro from him. Friday, 2:17 p.m.
Al Gore.
Mr. Vice President, this is, the Vice President.
Hey, Dick, can I ask you to hold on just for a couple seconds?
Sure, but...
Jason, I just don't think that that pod is a good follow-on from this pod. This is a kid in Iowa who's trying to break the Guinness record for rapping, right?
Yeah.
And this is the humorous pod on facial hair?
Yeah.
It's a bad fit. Let's just keep working on it.
Okay.
Sorry, TV business.
I'm sorry?
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
I'm sure you are, but by sorry, I meant what the hell are you talking about, TV business?
Oh, my network. I run a network for young people called Current.
A network?
Mm-hmm.
How many viewers?
Well, we've got deals in place already. Right now, as I'm talking to you, they give us a potential audience of 25 million.
Potential audience?
Mm-hmm.
That's fine. We got the potential of winning in Iraq. How many actual viewers?
Well, I know we have that dorm in Wyoming. Anyway, what's up? I've got pods to juggle.
Does the name Leandro Aragon Cilo or Chilo or Cilo, or does that name ring a bell?
Leandro Aragon Cilo. Mm-hmm. Didn't he do a video pod on the new salsa?
He worked for you. He worked for me. He was a holdover. Now he's a drag under. Gave secrets off my computer to foreigners.
Well, you changed the passwords when you came in.
My friend, we changed everything but the direction the toilet water flushed in.
Well, I don't remember much about the guy. When did he come in?
99.
Yeah, well, I was pretty busy those 2 years being blamed for inventing the internet, so...
So there's nothing you can tell me about our quick-fingered friend?
Oh, well, all I know is he had great qualifications when we hired him.
Really?
Oh, yes, sir. As a Filipino, he counted as both Hispanic and Asian. You get a twofer on the books, and you still end up with a guy.
I get you. Okay, Al. Sorry to bother you.
Oh, no problem. And Dick?
Yeah?
Any time you want to do a pod, you just let me know.
The last time I heard somebody talk so much about pods, I was watching a science fiction movie. Leandro, unlike Rome, would not be destroyed in a day. End of partial diary for early October 2005. Sincerely yours, Dick Cheney. Confidential.
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 Thank you.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for me to read the trades for you. It's a copyrighted feature of this broadcast, as you well know. Today, the trades feature news from the digital wonderland. First, Stevens pushing 2009 end to analog TV from Multichannel News. I'll read that first, and then a humorous follow-up. And I'll read that for you, too. Of course, it's all humorous, really. Dateline Washington Senate, well, we'll see. Dateline Washington Senate Commerce Committee Chairman Ted Stevens, Republican of Alaska, is pushing to end analog TV service in 2009 in an effort to reduce the financial burden on the federal government to ensure a smooth transition to digital transition to digital transmission. They're rhyming over at Multichannel News. Some in the House or the Senate favor 2007 or 2008 because some of the spectrum recovered from analog TV stations can be more quickly reallocated to police and emergency squads clamoring for a clean swath of the airwaves. Although Stevens favors getting spectrum into the hands of first responders, he's supporting 2009 because it would maximize revenue from the auction of analog TV spectrum. That is the part of the spectrum that they don't give away to the first responders, you see, and give consumers additional time to purchase digital TVs. Quote, the later the hard date is, the more digital televisions people will have bought on their own, and the fewer set-top boxes would be needed, Stevens said. Well, Senator, why not wait till 2050? We'll all have them then. Everything will be fine. No, no such luck. The Senate Commerce Committee is expected to vote on Stevens' plan October 19th. He said nothing had been decided on whether to force cable to carry all free programming services offered by digital TV stations, which has been a big stumbling block, as you know if you've been listening to this program. The federal government is likely to spend hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions, we have all that money, don't we? To subsidize digital set-top boxes for all or some of the 20 million households that rely on free TV, Stevens said. Stevens wants a co-payment. I don't know how much it'll be, he says, $25, whatever it is. But we want a small co-payment, not to raise the money, but to make sure people understand that this is a process that is very expensive and everyone must pay part of the cost. Because we got all that money, might as well pay billions to switch to digital. And from TVtechnology.com, the other side of the coin, literally, if budget reconciliation is any indication, the government will have to pay someone to take the analog broadcast spectrum in 10 years. The Senate Commerce Committee has put the auction value of that spectrum that will be freed up when analog TV goes dark at $10 billion. Back in 1997, the value was codified at $26 billion. Between then and now, estimates spiked as high as $70 billion, sparking charges that broadcasters were squatting on beachfront spectrum. The $10 billion estimate was related by Chairman Ted Stevens. There's that guy again. One broadcaster later wondered how such valuations are calculated. When in 2009 should analog TV be shut down? Several Capitol Hill watchers, according to TVtechnology.com, say they're hearing July rather than New Year's Day. Lawmakers would prefer to be in session in the event of an analog shutdown so that statements of blame can be issued immediately. And the one thing Stephen said he feared the most, more than spiders, Ted, was seeing the spectrum auction proceeds, whether they're $70 billion or $10 billion, funneled into disaster recovery. The money should be used in this system and not in other areas, he said. They're all heart. It becomes clear every time I read the trades for you. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, James Murdoch, the chief executive of British Sky Broadcasting, now faces a shareholder revolt precipitated by the actions of his father, the media mogul Rupert. The dispute focuses attention on the relationships between James, his father, and their business interests. One of Britain's most influential fund managers has written to Sky Television, run by son James, saying it will vote against the company's request for an exemption from takeover rules. The fund manager says it is taking a stand against Sky because, quote, it no longer trusts Rupert Murdoch. It's a broad issue of integrity, says the head of the fund. Unquote. And that concludes this edition of Le Show. What more can one say? The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide. One could say it's not true, but on the USEN 440 cable system in Japan or around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz, around the world via your computer at two different locations, live and archived, harryshear.com and kcrw.com, whenever you want it. Available as a free download at audible.com/LeShow, available on channel 136 at Sirius Satellite Radio, and is available as a free podcast from kcrw.com. And it would be just like me saying, that's not true, if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. A tip of the Le Show chapeau to the San Diego and Pittsburgh desks. Le Show playlists available at harryshearer.com. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.